Well, good afternoon. Lecture number 21. Guided tour of different types of special purpose maps. That's maps whose theme is a particular discipline or a particular kind of activity. And thematic cartography more generally. So we'll look at the gamut of types of thematic maps. If you remember, I made the distinction between today, cartographs, which are indeed, even though they don't maps associated with weather and climate, and so on. We'll look specifically at geology maps and show you some historical maps and contrast those with history maps, which are modern maps showing some aspect of history. We'll look a little bit at extraterrestrial mapping and some of the issues that we face when we have to map other planets or other bodies. We'll talk about journalism and the impact of the internet, and we'll finish by looking at tactual maps or haptic maps, maps that give feel response. Okay, so this is basically a slideshow today. Let's start with this particular map. This map is just loaded with information. It's on violent crime in the United States from 1978 to 1998. During a period during which crime was generally speaking dropping in the United States. And here we've got a combination of several different mapping methods in use all at the same time. So as I said, this is pretty loaded. The first thing to point out is that the size of the symbol is proportional to the data value associated with it. So this is a proportional symbol type map, as we met a little while ago. We're also using the circle as a histogram, and we're showing, in this case, four different types of crime on the same chart. So the size and the division is also significant. And then we have blue symbols that represent declining crime rates, and yellow symbols or tan symbols that represent increasing crime rates. So you can very quickly look at this entire picture. Just notice a couple of things here. It's often true when we've got tiny states like we have in the East Coast, the symbols can't overlap those because we wouldn't be able to see them. You know, Connecticut would disappear off the map. So we have moved the symbols out to sea, and we've got these lines that join features onto to their actual geographic location. Sometimes those features are in the shape of hooks. They're called land hooks on cadastral maps. Okay, so sticking with that theme, here is a more traditional choropleth map in which we've simply used shades of, my batteries are running out here, in which we've used shades of green to represent the intensity of a value. In this case, I believe it's family income or something like that in Toronto. If we can do choropleth in one dimension, it's been experimented that we can also do it in two dimensions. So this is a so-called bivariate choropleth map, in which we've got two variables represented simultaneously by choropleth-type legends. And you see that there was one going off this way and one going off this way. And then we have combinations of the two different colors. So along the diagonal, we have grays. So if we stay within the normal range for both variables, we'd expect to be increasing density of gray. But if we go off towards any one extreme, then we become increasingly colored. So here we can relate two variables together. I believe this is GMP per capita and life expectancy for countries of Africa. This type of reporting you see very often in international maps, reports of the United Nations, those sorts of things. Okay, let's talk briefly about cartograms. What is a cartogram? A cartogram is a sort of a form of cartographic lie in which we make the area of the feature that we're trying to represent proportional to something other than its actual area in the real world. So you can imagine there are successive stages in creating a cartogram. You could imagine a proportional symbol map in which the symbols, let's say, are squares. representing, in this case, I would guess population by county or something like that. There's LA County, huge one here. And then we just simply move the squares around so that they connect together, generally speaking, in the same geographic arrangement that you had in the original. And we've created a cartogram. You notice that it's got all sorts of undesirable properties. The bay is barely recognizable up there. But we do get this message quite clear about where the population distribution is. Now, if we treat these instead of squares as bubbles, and then have the bubbles wiggle around until they're in approximately the correct location, this is called a Dorling cartogram, after Danny Dorling, the British cartographer who's done a lot of work with mapping social attributes for different cities and different populations. We can have cartograms that are contiguous. Notice that in this cartogram, we've got disjoint gaps between the units here, and we've had to end up with gaps like that one right there in this one. If instead we constrain it so that the map has to have the same topological connections between counties, this again is LA County, then we can continuously distort the area, usually iteratively, doing it one little bit at a time or one part of the map at a time. We can end up with what's called a contiguous cartogram, in which the area is still continuous as it is geographically, but looks a little bit different. We can form non-contiguous cartograms. This is where we simply leave gaps between the features. So here we just simply take the largest county, which LA again, and make that size correct, proportional to its actual size, and then shrink every other county in proportion compared to that size. You can see that many counties just sort of disappear off the map almost. We can do that keeping them in their correct location and therefore overlapping, or we can just move them apart so they don't overlap, and we end up with a pattern that looks kind of like a fragmented California, like something like this. These have been popularized recently. There are several shareware packages on the internet that you can download, put in your data, or choose a map of the United States and put in information about the counties and so on in a spreadsheet, and it will make a cartogram for you. So this one has been widely distributed because voting statistics or voting data, things like the Electoral College vote and the presidential elections, are much better when they're mapped on a base where you remove the effect of the different sizes of the states. So in this case, we've got a map of sort of voting power in the United States. And you can see that most of the Midwestern states disappear. There's, you know, Iowa up here that has enormous impact on the primaries and so on. It really just disappears off the map once the election time comes around. And you'll see that the larger states, New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, Florida, you can see the importance of Florida in elections, Texas, California come out as, and Illinois come out as the major players once you put it onto a cartogram space. This little animation shows that we can start with the normal basis, in this case of voting districts, and you can see the size of some of them in the Midwest, entire states represented by one congressman in much of the Midwest. That we can simply tell the computer to keep, you know, moving them around a little bit at a time until they end up with the resulting distortion. So many of these are so-called iterative algorithms that move the locations of the counties around or the voting districts around a little bit, and then keep and then adjust them to make sure it's right, and then do a little bit more and so on. Some various different types of maps. I mentioned Dorling cartograms. This is a Dorling cartogram. It makes Britain look like this ugly blob over here. This is a map that has three variables shown in color. It accounts for one variable because it's on a cartogram base by population. And then it uses what are called Chernoff faces after psychologist Chernoff, who invented these things. Apparently, human beings are really good at reading faces. That's what we do all the time. You know, it's a little baby looks into its mother's face as soon as it's born, pretty much. So we take the characteristics of the face. That's the size, the shape of the head, the location and shape of the eyes, the location and shape of the nose and the mouth, and hook those onto variables. So, you know, something that's very high has a smiley face, and something that's very low has a frown on it. And then we keep that up for all the different variables. And that allows you to see the relationships among the variables that we can put onto the Chernoff face. So in this case, we've got, I believe it's four variables on the face, three more in terms of color, all on a population base. So we're looking at 8 or 9 variables on the same map here. I would argue it's kind of hard to read anything on a map that has 8 or 9 variables, but you can at least see the enormous difference between London here and the surrounding area. So it's a little hard to read the faces there. Here's a map that won an award for design back in the 1970s by Gene Turner, showing Chernoff faces for quality of life aspects in Los Angeles. And true enough, you know, here's the smiley people, and here's the frowning people, depending upon where you live in LA. We can take this idea of a cartogram to its sort of ridiculous extreme. Here we've reduced each major metropolitan area in the world to a single square, and we're displaying some value, I don't even know what the value is, by color on this. And you can make the sort of statement that here we've removed the effect of geography and just looked at the world's major cities together and can therefore compare them by value. Okay, let's talk a little bit about extraterrestrial mapping. You notice that we spent a lot of time at the beginning of the quarter talking about graticules, latitude and longitude grids, and coordinate systems like the universal transverse Mercator. Well, the nice thing about those systems is they work on pretty much any shaped planet. So we can use latitude and longitude on the Moon or on Mars or Jupiter or even for the entire solar system, as we'll see in just a minute. And it works perfectly well. The trouble is that not all planets are as nicely evenly shaped as the Earth. Sometimes they've got bigger lumps and bumps in them. So we have to have quite a big rendering from the geoid onto the initial ellipsoid before you can then project. A couple of things to note is that a lot of planets don't have water on them. And some of them are all liquid or all gas on the surface, so elevation begins to take on different meanings as we go from place to place. Here the color scheme that we use is sort of arbitrary, but because it's got blue at the far end of the scheme, we sort of associate blue with water by cartographic convention. There is no water on Mars, it just looks that way. Here's the great spot, which is an indentation, probably an impact crater. So we've noticed that on the Moon here, there are an enormous number of place names, and it's because they've been looking at the Moon for a very long time. It was mislabeled initially as having seas before we knew and proved that it had no water, actually it does have water on it, but not in liquid form. And so a lot of these features were mislabeled, and then they were given commemorative names. So a lot of things in space are named after famous scientists or famous expeditions, or even in some cases spaceships. So place names get kind of interesting once you get outside beyond the Earth. Okay, maps are kind of everywhere. They're sort of ubiquitous. It's been one of the themes of the class. It's pretty much wherever you go, you find them. Some interesting characteristics. They still indeed do inhabit many people's glove compartments. And there are a whole series of maps that are manufactured specially for this market. The things like the Thomson guides that are designed deliberately to fold over into a glove compartment-sized single page so that you can shove it into the glove compartment at any time. And they fit within that space. The pop-up maps are kind of unique. I once met the guy that invented the folding machine that creates these things. They basically concertina down into a flat shape, and then when you open the two sides up, the map pops up into form. You can get these from pretty much every city in the country, and many specialty ones like the subway systems in New York, for example. Here's a special purpose map designed for people on bikes with a holder so that you can put it in front of you while you're on the bike. In the UK, in London, before you are allowed to drive a taxi in London, you have to go through what's called getting the knowledge. And getting the knowledge involves over 6 months of riding a bicycle or sometimes a motorbike around the streets of London, learning all the principal routes by heart. And you very much need one of these to be able to get around. So if you ever get into a taxi in London, you should be able to name any street anywhere in the city, and the driver should know exactly how to get you there. And a lot of these are a special purpose for travel. Some of these are quite elaborate, so that there are paper-based systems that were designed to fit in the cockpit of an aircraft, where you could actually turn little cranks, so the map, as you flew along the route, the map continued to appear, kind of like a triptych map. Back many years ago, the Automobile Association would actually print you a triptych map and mail it to you before a trip. So if you're going to drive across the country, you could say you were going on a particular route, say I-80, and they would send you the I-80 strip map. So that basically you traveled on one page a day, so you could flip the page over at the end of the day onto the next highway map. Speaking of highway maps, they're pretty much ubiquitous. Into the turn of about 1915, 1920 onward, up until the 40s and 50s, they were given away as advertising, primarily for cars and gas stations and brands of gas. And as a result, people sort of didn't treat them with a great deal of respect. You know, that's how they got jammed into the glove compartment in the first place. Highway maps are very much collector's items now, especially if you can find old ones. Many map libraries and museums now collect these and treat them as works of art. Important things that are different on highway maps identifiers, the shield system on the roads, and the numbers here that correspond to driving distances. And I was just doing some research the other day into the history of this. Apparently, here in the United States, people started buying and driving cars around in the 1910s. And at that time, there were no standard labels for highways. There were no official state highway designations to drive around across the country. As an interesting side note, it was the 1919 expedition to cross the country by a military wheeled convoy that left from the zero milestone marker was designed to get around this problem exactly, to be able to figure out where the principal roads were. And in fact, young Dwight Eisenhower was actually one of the people on that expedition who later on funded the highway system that gave us the interstate system. So it was the map companies that started putting up road signs to direct people around. And the first companies that did this didn't produce maps, they produced photographs. So they took views of looking along the road with a little arrow drawn on it to show you where to make the turn. And then later they figured it was easier to just go and nail an arrow up or a label up on a fence post or up on a telephone pole. And that system eventually was standardized and taken over by the states and became the Highway Convention naming system that we currently have. So there's a lot of history in highway maps. And this is an absolutely generic sort of world map. This one showing world climates with the Köppen and other climate classification systems. You find these in textbooks, in atlases, reference sources on the internet. Extremely common. Generally speaking, you often see these in compromised projections. This looks like the Robinson projection in this particular case. This one has a rather elaborate legend along with it. Notice the arrow up here. If I simply slide that over here, obviously it's wrong. So we have to be very careful of the north arrows and which direction is north. If we have a graticule on the map, generally speaking, we don't need a north arrow. So there's an enormous amount of interest in climate and climate change these days, and almost every one of the sources of information, primarily on the internet, puts out maps, and they're usually very highly colorful maps and very eye-catching. This one struck me as interesting. 1997 was an unusual year here in Southern California. It was an El Nino year, and had an enormous amount of rainfall fell that year here. In Santa Barbara and Goleta. And you can quite clearly see the El Nino effect here, now called the El Nino Southern Oscillation, heating up the Pacific. So here we've chosen to use point symbols they're arrayed along a regular grid, so the data is actually coming in a gridded format, in this case, probably by latitude and longitude increments. And the size of the symbol is proportional to the number of degrees Celsius in the temperature variation. So you can see that the effect of normal climate fluctuation, an El Nino year, is to heat some areas up and cool others down. This is why climate change is such a confusing thing to figure out what the impacts of it exactly are. We find maps of temperature and precipitation pretty much uniform. If you're taking a physical geography class, you'll probably spend a lot of time looking at these kinds of maps. Here's a map that shows temperature anomalies or long-term trends in temperature increase by region in California. You notice that often things like climate are highly correlated with topography, so the Central Valley has its own region in terms of temperature increase. If I read that correctly, we're looking at over the last century, a 2.5 degree rise Fahrenheit in temperature in this area. That's quite a significant difference. Here we see a precipitation map. It's a nice colorful one. So it's an internet-based map. You notice that it's kind of garish in terms of color. That's often the case. But here you can see this enormous effect just on, this is on the Big Island of Hawaii. We can see that on the rainy side of the island, we get enormous high rainfalls. In this case, 300 inches of rain a year. It's just staggering amounts of rain. So a typical image of Hawaii is this sort of lush tropical garden. But it means that there's a rain shadow or a very dry opposite side on the islands, where in fact on the Big Island there are actually cattle ranches on the Big Island in some of these drier regions. So enormous variation within a small area in terms of the amount of precipitation that can fall. And precipitation modeling and using computer models to simulate actual amounts of population is something that's done quite commonly. In fact, we have a research group, the Climate Hazards Research Group here in Geography, that actually does this kind of work on doing more accurate estimates of precipitation and rainfall, primarily in Africa. We're used to seeing maps like this. This is off weather.com, I think, or the Weather Channel. You can see that we've got both numbers being indicated for principal cities in this case, but corresponding to weather stations where actual measurements are being made. This is obviously in degrees Fahrenheit. And then we've used hypsometric tinting and coloring to overlay. We've also sort of overlaying a little bit of a hill-shaded map so you can see some of the texture associated with the country. I would argue this has become probably the map people see the most after, say, Google Maps. It's on the back page of USA Today every day and so on, this exact same map. We've become increasingly used to seeing high-resolution radar images. In fact, if you go to the National Weather Service website, you can look at any one of several different satellite or sensed instruments in not exactly real time, but certainly within loops, like this particular radar loop here. So this display of national radar is so common now, you even see it in airports as you go to board your plane. There it is on the TV screen. You can see the National Weather Map. There are websites that just embed this in their headers. Then we have local, often Doppler radars. Radars that are so precise that we can see whether or not this little tiny individual cloud is dropping rain. But certainly we can see entire systems develop very easily from these. I once sat in a hotel room in South Dakota as a tornado system was developing and watched this map continuously. And the guy came in from the National Weather Service and was very good at pointing out the exact circumstances that lead to the formation of tornadoes. And you can indeed see them developing, and you can see them very clearly on these Doppler images. Okay, we've looked at some satellite systems for navigation, the GPS system. We've looked at some satellite systems for sending back images of the Earth for mapping purposes. Here's yet another use of satellites for monitoring the weather. There are large numbers of satellites that just simply monitor the conditions of the atmosphere and send that information back. Ironically, we can actually get weather and ionospheric information from by reading and interpreting the GPS signal as well. So we get an enormous amount of data from space about the weather and about the atmosphere. So the one that most people use and that's been on duty for a very long time now is the GOES, the geostationary series of satellites that's operated primarily by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. When you flip the TV news on, it's usually that information that you'll see. Under normal circumstances, there are two GOES satellites in geostationary orbit. That means they orbit at exactly the same speed that the Earth rotates. There are two, one over the east coast, one over the west coast. This is GOES West in this case, and we're seeing visible light here. So you're seeing the banks of cloud coming in pretty much like the weather we had last weekend over our area. A few years ago when one of the two, I forget whether it was east or west, failed, they actually moved in orbit so that it was positioned directly over the center of the country, so one satellite could do the job of two for a proportion of the time. But since most of our weather comes from over the Pacific and towards the pole, especially the severe weather, it makes more sense to know about the west rather than the east. So here we can see the edge of the satellite collection frame, and here we've projected the data exactly the way it would be on a map projection, and we've added a graticule, and this is quite clearly a conic projection that's being used for showing the weather. Okay, let's move over into geology, another specialized discipline that needs its own special purpose maps. Almost all of the maps that, not quite all, but many of the maps that are used in geology are really surface maps, so they're area thematic maps that just show a single category. And you might say this is nominal type data. And here we have the various different rock types being shown and their outcrops. And you can see that we also have some linear features because discontinuities in the surface geology clearly represent something going on in terms of structure, so often fault lines. And you can see the series of fault lines converging here and the San Andreas Fault running up the coast of California. So geological maps are often entire series. They correspond and many times use as their base the same topographic maps that we're used to seeing, but they cover the surface like this rather than putting contours and so on. Now, the very famous series of maps covering surface geology that's produced by the USGS, the same group that does the topographic mapping, but there are other groups that do mapping within California, certainly within our local area. Very famous are the Dibley maps, named for Tom Dibley, a guy who lived right here in Santa Barbara, who spent his entire career mapping on foot most of Southern California and huge parts of the rest of the state, and producing his own series of interpreted geological maps. So this is what a geological map might look like. Here we've got our standard topographic map, and you might recognize the Kaibab Plateau. Here's the famous Bright Angel Trailhead and the Bright Angel Lodge in the South Kaibab Plateau area there, and the Phantom Ranch down here on the Colorado River. You can see that what we've been concerned with, the things like the township and range descriptions, the vegetation patterns, the contours and so on the geological map, those all disappear into a sort of faded gray in the background. And instead now what we're interested in is the surface outcrops of different rocks. So you notice that here we've got very thin exposures as we go down downhill, down into the Grand Canyon. And then we can see the structure of the folds and faults being marked on here, which is quite complex down here as we get towards the river and so on. Now, some of the symbols on geological maps vary quite considerably from those that we see on topographic maps. For one thing, often they have standard symbol sets that correspond to the different types of rock. So conglomerates are always shown with an irregular pattern, igneous rocks always shown with little crosses and so on, so that they're universally recognizable. Limestone always shown as looking like bricks on the map. Then we have fault lines, and they're often marked in terms of direction of movement, and they're usually marked in terms like here, showing their strike and the dip. So strike and dip are two important properties to being able to interpret three-dimensional structure, what's going on under the earth on a map. So if we go out into the field and we've got, say, a single rock that's outcropping at the surface here, we say that meets the surface at a dip angle. So if it meets it vertically, in other words, it's been turned right over on its side, the way some of the geology here along our coastline has been, then you're at a dip of a 90-degree angle. And as it becomes more and more shallow, if the bedding rocks are pretty much the way the gravity of them is exactly the way it is today, then the dip angle approaches zero. And then we also talk about the strike direction. That's the rock unit, as it comes to the surface, occurs along a bed with a given direction. So we give that a direction. So here there's the symbol that's typically used. It has a straight line that shows the strike direction, and then a little arrow at 90 degrees, and usually a number that represents the dip magnitude in degrees. So here is a section of a map that's been made, and you can see that it's got dips and strikes in all sorts of different directions. So this is quite complicated geology, and this would be typically what a geologist would do: would go out and measure all these dips and strikes, usually using a Brunton compass, which conveniently, when you put it on a slope, has a little scale with a dangling arrow that falls down by gravity. So you just simply put your compass on its side on top of the rock, and you can measure off the angle of dip, record that on your map, and then come back and try and figure out what on earth is going on underneath the ground. Look at this sort of map of the three-dimensional structure and try and figure out what's happening in the three-dimensional form underneath the ground. Now, I'm not very good at interpreting these, but there are geologists that can just simply glance at that and say, oh, it must be three layers of rock, one's wider than the other, and it's moving at this direction. So they can actually look at something like that and see it, or at least visualize it in three dimensions. Okay, so I said I'd talk a little bit about history and historical maps. And the agencies that produce maps in the United States obviously go back a long way. The origins of the U.S. Geological Survey and the mapping efforts in this country are very closely tied in with the history of the country. So it was the expedition by Lewis and Clark, not long after government was formed and the Constitution was ratified, that was sent off to explore through the river system up the Missouri River across the United States to try and reach the Pacific coast. And in fact, did so. It's an amazing story. If you want to read about it, there are dozens of books written about it. This was a commemorative reproduction of their map in the report that they eventually gave back to the president, showing the way west. As it was, they were simply just the first people to traverse it and narrate it. Obviously, a lot of people already lived out in the Great Plains of the United States and the West at the time. But they brought the information back literally as they were returning. The first waves of settlers were beginning to move out to these territories. Most of these maps are collected and kept in the National Archives. There are several extremely good historical map collections under federal government control in Washington and elsewhere. There are some good private collections as well. A good example would be the Huntington Library in Los Angeles, which has an extraordinary collection of historical maps if you're interested in them. They always say this is one of the most famous maps. It certainly is the most expensive. This was sold at auction, a copy of this sold at auction for over $10 million. Why is this so unique? Well, we can recognize now what it is. It's not really a map, it's a set of gores for making a globe. So these would have been printed, cut out, and then pasted onto a globe to make an Earth. Now, the reason this was worth $10 million is that here you can see the old world, Africa and Asia. And here we can see a new continent. This was Valsamolo was the first cartographer who realized that Columbus's discoveries actually did represent a new world, and that we better start putting it on the maps. And we can see bits of it here. I hadn't realized that it was had an isthmus in the middle and so on. But a very important part of this map is the label right there. Waldseemüller had no name to put on this new continent, so he gave a lot more credit to Vespucci's exploration descriptions of Brazil than he did to Columbus's rather misguided information. So he chose to name it after Amerigo Vespucci, and he called the continent America, and later it became North and South. I always say it's just by a complete fluke that we don't live in the United States of Vespucci land. Okay, we can make make maps of historical events, and indeed there are even historical maps of historical events. Indeed, one of the original maps used at the Battle of Yorktown in the Revolution was the second largest amount of money ever paid for a map, simply because it must have been in George Washington's hands and actually used during the battle. So things like Civil War maps, maps of, in this case, the Battle of Gettysburg, pretty much every book that's ever been written about any historical major event around the history of the nation gets one or more of these maps included in it. And they're often simplified topographic maps. Often we need details, like if you can't study Gettysburg without understanding Pickett's Charge, a very important part of the battle, or the Little Round Top incident. So these general flows and movements, we've seen these lines on maps before. They represent line type maps and often flow information. So here's the Pickett's Charge itself right here. Now, one of the more widely published maps of the first Gulf War was the invasion map for Kuwait that was used by the press for seemingly forever. Here we've got all the commemorative insignia of all the different groups that were involved, because it was a United Nations effort. There were hundreds of countries involved, and they all had to play their role, and they all had to get their emblem on the map. And here's the famous end run, the Hail Mary pass that cut off the entire country and went directly to the heart of it to liberate Kuwait. That turned out well, didn't it? Okay, here's the African slave trade being shown on an atlas map. Again, using these long flow arrows showing the indication direction of movement of the slave trade. And the parts of the slave trade that are extremely well studied, like the migrations into the Caribbean, North America. Some parts of it are extremely understudied, like the movements into South America and North Africa. Okay, we can, just as we can take an outside view and look in, so create a globe map of the Earth, we can take the view looking outwards from the Earth, that's the view of the skies, and map those onto a sphere as well. So you might call this sort of an inverted sphere, because it's actually open and we're putting it onto a three-dimensional form, but otherwise the geometry is exactly the same. And in fact, we use map projections for mapping the night sky in very much the same way as we use them for cartography. In fact, up until quite recently, only about 100 or 150 years ago, you never bought a globe. You always bought a pair, a globe and a star globe. So globes always came in pairs. And we can talk about the equator and line of sight and directions. We often use gnomic projections, or a view that you would get simply by looking outwards on sky maps. And recently, the Sky Survey, huge attempt to map the entire night sky and all of the objects in it, has made an agreement with Google so that Google Earth, you can now look outwards and see the stars from any given point as well on their maps. Now we begin to survey looking outwards on a much broader scale than we ever did before, with radio surveys and X-rays to see things like pulsars. And new discoveries seem to be getting made all the time. We've got these mysteries like the missing matter and so on, the dark matter, and predictions that the distribution of mass in the universe should be a lot more uniform than it actually is. As you can see, it's not uniform. It has lumps and bumps, pretty much like the Earth, you might say. And therefore, there's a lot more discovery still to be made simply by mapping the night sky and its properties. So looking a little bit more at the popular media, maps often play a really essential role in telling the news stories. In fact, there are entire books written about maps and journalism and how they're used within journalism. This is just a couple of maps that I pulled out. This is one, I think, from the CNN website, looking at population distribution in China and population density and the increasing specter of overpopulation as we reach, we've just passed 7 billion people on Earth. And this, I felt, was a really good narrative map that was produced along with the news coverage of the 9/11 attacks in New York City and in Washington, D.C. And in this case, we got a huge perspective looking at the entire East Coast and seeing where each one of the planes flew so that we could see how they converged on each spot. So each of these has not only a track line on the ground corresponding to the flight of the plane, but we also have a sort of timeline. And we've got events along the timeline being played out here in narrative. But the timeline, we've got times marked along these, so they're almost like isochrones, except they're around individual events around the maps. Maps on television, you do see them all the time. I mean, they always say, well, nice thing about statistics is that 60% of them are made up on the spot. I'll make up another one now and say that a good half of all TV news announcers actually sit in front of a map in the background in some way, means, or form. And things like the BBC are known for their rotating globes, in spite of the fact that for many years their globe rotated the wrong way on the BBC. When we get maps on television, they have all sorts of different constraints than the maps we might see printed or we might see on the internet. For one thing, broadcast television up until the high-definition era really made mincemeat out of the primary colors, especially the reds and blues. That's why newscasters always wear blue jackets and so on. They try and avoid these effects. So often we see maps that are incredibly simplified, like this map of Africa, just simply showing us where Africa is and where Nigeria is, and then where is Lagos within Nigeria. That's all the content that you need if it's accompanying, say, a red article about whatever is happening in Lagos today. Sometimes they get a little bit more involved. So this was pulled from the BBC during the 2005 terrorist attacks there. In which the events were happening mostly on the underground system, mostly in the city of London, and people knew and understood the underground map, as we saw in the last lecture, but they knew and understood it in a distorted form. So here we see the lines actually where they really are, and you can see that there was a relationship between them. Now, the only exception is to them all, the attacks all happening at underground stations or on underground trains was this one in Tavistock Square, which blew off the top of a bus. There's a commemorative plaque there right now. I stayed in a hotel last year right across the street from it. Okay, when we think about mapping today, we primarily think about the internet. So the internet has become the distribution mechanism for cartography. And you could say that the internet every day generates more maps than we made in all of history up to the invention of the internet. And you'd be pretty much correct, because they all had to be printed on paper beforehand. The first thing that the internet has given us is the sense of connectivity, the idea of links and nodes within networks. And we talked about networks in a recent lecture, but the actual mass of the internet that occasionally gets mapped, there are internet sites that map every hit that they get. We often think of it as a sort of a branching tree type network where people and objects and things are connected together, URLs are connected together, people on Facebook are connected together, and so on. But from a more traditional cartographic point of view, I would argue that the internet has really given us three things, or you might say it's massively reduced the cost of three things. The first one is animation. It used to take, well, it used to be impossible to do animation. It used to take months to create an animation. The first one I ever created, I had to program in assembler from scratch. on a first generation Apple II computer. Now they're relatively straightforward, and the tools to create them are so simple we can even do them in class, during cartography class. So here's a little map showing the same spread west that we saw on the Lewis and Clark map, in this case by incorporation, by annexation and then incorporation into states. There's a really good animation showing the continent of Europe over all of known history and how all the kingdoms and country boundaries changed. But I would argue there are two other things that are very important that the internet has made simple and easy. The first one is interactivity. So this little tool here is designed to help kids memorize the state capitals. So I can just simply roll my cursor over the state, which helps me to learn the states and their outlines, and up pops, in this case Sacramento has popped up as the label for California. So people want to memorize state capitals and think that's geography can now have fantastic tools to be able to do so. And this interactivity we now take for granted, such that if a little kid picks up sits in front of a computer and opens up a website, they're clicking on everything because they expect something to happen by clicking. And the third aspect, I would argue, that's sort of revolutionized cartography is the ability to embed, in this case, sound, but also video, into maps and images. Probably best represented by Google Earth and its ability to embed just about anything you want within it. This website I studied recently with a student, this is called the Sound Seeker. So this is a public website for New York City where you can, if you've made a high-quality sound recording, you can upload it to its location. So you can explore the city and the sounds of the city by clicking on individual locations. And there are all sorts of things in there, like there's a lunch counter at LaGuardia Airport and Central Park by the lake and things like that. So I would argue that the web has given us an appreciation for networks, the ability to very easily do interaction and to embed sounds and animation into our maps, things that weren't at all possible before. So getting away from the digital end, you could also say that there are movements happening on the hard analog end of cartography as well. And that is making spatial information and maps accessible to people who don't have sight. And here's a standard set of teaching maps that is distributed through school systems that allow students who are blind to be able to memorize the outlines of continents and countries and the locations of capitals and be able to read in Braille off of the maps what is in each location. Here's one for the Mall area in Washington, D.C., I believe this one's out of a tourist center somewhere. And here's a guide to an individual building. So you might find this in a building entrance so that you can actually feel your way to find out where the elevators are or where so-and-so's office is. And last time I was in Hong Kong, I went through the Hung Hom Station, which is how you get anywhere out of Hong Kong, and was very surprised to see this beautifully made stainless steel Braille map for the blind, as it says here. Of course, the character's in Chinese, a little hard to read, but it's also written here in English. And this is actually a map of the station that allows you to feel your way around the station and then be able to go to the correct location. Okay, so here's today's lecture. We've looked at lots of different special purpose thematic maps like geological maps or extraterrestrial maps that serve a particular function or other discipline. We looked at cartograms. They're really very powerful tools for communication, and we're finding them increasingly being used by the news media and so on. And we've looked at some of the different applications that use maps quite extensively, weather reporting, geology, travel, and so on. We've looked at different media, books, magazines, newspapers, and television. And they all use maps to a different extent, but I've singled out the web as being unique because it's really enabled parts of cartography that weren't well developed at all in the past. Interactivity, animation, and incorporation of multimedia, including sound. And then maps, as I said, if you took all the maps that are made on the internet every day, that's probably equal to the entire amount that was made in history before, say, 1900. So maps are really ubiquitous and have become an important part of pretty much everybody's life. If you've got an iPhone in your pocket, you're carrying around a unique map of the world. Okay, see you all on, what's today, Wednesday, on Friday. Forgot the day of the week for a minute.